Hello, and welcome to this podcast focusing on precision oncology in non-small cell lung cancer. In this episode, which includes experts from a recent educational symposium, Drs. Helena Yu, Jacob Sands, and Sarah Goldberg will discuss the rapidly evolving landscape of HER2 and TROP2 directed therapies in non-small cell lung cancer, covering the spectrum of targeted agents from antibody drug conjugates to novel HER2 selective tyrosine kinase inhibitors, along with key clinical trial data and practical strategies for managing the unique adverse event profiles associated with these treatments. This activity is provided by PER and is supported by educational grants from AstraZeneca, Daiichi Sankyo, and Gilead Sciences. In the first segment, Dr. Yu reviews the landscape of HER2 alterations in non-small cell lung cancer and the clinical data supporting HER2-directed antibody drug conjugates and novel HER2 selective tyrosine kinase inhibitors.
I think all of us had drilled into us that obviously biomarker testing in non-small cell lung cancer is really critical. We can do it on tissue or blood, and it really just gives us more options for our patients and gives them improved outcomes and, of course, recommended in all the guidelines. So this is why, right? I think we have a lot of approved targeted therapies, obviously, particularly in the first line setting, which is why it's really critical to do this testing prior to initiation of treatment, if possible. So HER2 alterations, I'll spend a minute on the slide because I do think it's important. When we say HER2 positive lung cancer, we can mean a lot of different things. We can mean HER2 mutations, and these are usually insertions in exon 20. Rare, I think about 2% of non-small cell lung cancers have this. There are HER2 gene amplifications, which we can find, and HER2 mutations, really, we find those on NGS largely. HER2 gene amplifications, also rare, probably about 2%, and these can be found by FISH or NGS. And these are usually mutually exclusive. Patients have in their tumors have either HER2 gene amplification or HER2 mutations. And then there's HER2 protein expression. And this is, of course, on a spectrum. When we think about low or moderate expression, that can happen in about 20 to 30% of patients with non-small cell lung cancer. But really high 3+ expression is also probably rare, less than 5%. And usually patients that have gene amplification do have HER2 protein overexpression. But I would say that not all patients with protein overexpression have gene amplification. So HER2 mutations, these are commonly, as I mentioned, in exon 20. The vast majority are these YVMA insertions that you can see that probably are more than half of HER2 insertions. There are some other kinase domain point mutations, and then there are also extracellular domain point mutations, probably most common, the S310X. And all of these are activating and also sensitizing to the different HER2 targeted therapies that we have. And this is an actionable gene alteration. It has that same phenotypic enrichment like EGFR or ALK, where patients tend to be never smokers, women. And we do know that there is tropism for these cancers to the central nervous system, so a high incidence of brain metastases in HER2 positive lung cancer. And so what therapies do we have? We have antibodies, which are kind of historical treatments. We have antibody drug conjugates. And then more recently, we have had some HER2 mutant-specific tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And so we'll touch upon the latter two here. So the first drug to this space is one that breast cancer docs are familiar with, TDM1, trastuzumab, adotrastuzumab, emtansine. So this is a HER2-directed antibody drug conjugate. And of course, these ADCs have an antibody component, a linker, and then a chemotherapy payload. A newer agent that, again, all of us are quite familiar with, trastuzumab deruxtecan. This has the deruxtecan backbone payload. You're going to hear more about datopotamab, which has that same chemotherapy payload. It's a topo-1-based exatecan derivative payload, which a lot of the ADCs that are either on the market or in development have. And then it has that same trastuzumab antibody. So the first study that looked at TDXD is the DESTINY-Lung01 study. And so this had several cohorts. It really had a group that was moderate or high IHC expressing HER2, and then a HER2 mutant cohort. So again, having those exon 20 insertions or point mutations. And these were all patients that had metastatic non-small cell lung cancer, had received chemotherapy or prior treatment. Primary endpoint of this study was overall response. And so you can see here, this is definitely a very active agent. Overall response rate was 55%, median PFS 8.2 months. And so majority of patients had tumor shrinkage on this agent. The next study was a DESTINY-Lung02 study. So really, this compared two different doses of T-DXd. So the 5.4 mg per kg and the 6.4 mg per kg, and really trying to get a sense of safety and efficacy for those two doses. Primary endpoint, again, was overall response. And you can see both doses, of course, were active. You can see the majority of patients, again, had tumor shrinkage. And I think here, this is really focusing on 5.4 mg per kg. The safety, in particular, pneumonitis was better with 5.4, and efficacy quite similar between the two doses. And so you can see the median PFS with T-DXd at 5.4 was 9.9 months, and with a median overall survival of 19.5 months. And so really, this was the dose that in lung cancer was chosen to move forward. And as I mentioned, these patients tend to have brain metastases or develop or have a predisposition to develop brain metastases. So understanding intracranial efficacy really is critical. And we have some of this data from breast cancer as well, that T-DXd certainly penetrates the blood-brain barrier. And you can see that, looking at measurable intracranial disease, this does seem to be an active drug where patients who have parenchymal brain mets do have disease shrinkage in the CNS with T-DXd. So this study is ongoing, has completed accrual, but we're waiting for results. So this is the DESTINY-Lung04 study. So T-DXd is approved in the second line setting after platinum-based chemotherapy. But of course, for these targeted agents, we want to be able to use them in the first line setting. And so this is T-DXd versus chemo-IO, chemo-immunotherapy for patients with HER2-positive or mutant lung cancer. And so we await data from here. But since T-DXd has come to the arena, we really have seen very quickly the development of these different HER2-targeted tyrosine kinase inhibitors. So we've had historical more pan-HER, pan-HER TKIs like afatinib that have been assessed with really modest activity and significant toxicity. But zongertinib is, again, one of those HER2 mutant specific TKIs. And so the BEAMEON-Lung01 study was this multi-cohort study. So because T-DXd is already in the market, there was a few different cohorts. And I think the two of interest are patients that had platinum-based chemotherapy, but no prior HER2-directed targeted therapy, but then also the patients who had platinum as well as T-DXd. Because we have this active ADC as well, we want to know whether drugs that have different mechanisms of action can be sequenced and still have efficacy, or is there cross-resistance? And then this study is ongoing, the BEAMEON-Lung02 study, which is the first-line study. So looking at zongertinib as first-line, right? This is really impressive activity that really is better than platinum-based chemotherapy for these patients. So, of course, we want to use these agents in the first-line setting. And so just this year, a few months ago, last year, we had the approval of zongertinib for previously treated patients after chemotherapy, and then the FDA kind of changed the label of the accelerated approval to include like line agnostic treatment. So it also allowed patients treated with HER2 mutant lung cancer as an initial treatment option. And so this really, I think, has changed our standard of care. And so patients with HER2 positive or mutant lung cancer really should get a targeted therapy in that first line setting. And then, as I mentioned, intracranial response really critical in the space. And so, again, this does seem to be, you know, a lot of the TKIs we know from osimertinib, lorlatinib, alectinib, we know them to be small molecules that can penetrate the blood-brain barrier. And it's the same with zongertinib, where really we can see pretty robust intracranial responses that are quite similar to the systemic response, or really seeing equal extracranial, intracranial responses to zongertinib. Another drug in this space is sevabertinib. very similar to zongertinib, where it is a HER2 mutant specific tyrosine kinase inhibitor. The SOHO-01 study was the study that looked at severbertinib, and again, in those similar cohorts, patients that had received prior chemotherapy and then also chemotherapy as well as T-DXd. And you can see, the sort of similar demographics that the other studies have enrolled. Primary endpoint of this study was overall response as well. Sorry, these are very small and hard for me to read as well, but overall response rate was 64%, so right in range with zongertinib. And then the median progression-free survival is 8.3 months for patients that are HER2-targeted therapy naive. And then, so I think the real question is sequencing. Now that we, over the last few years, have active therapies in this space, how are we going to sequence? I think right now we only have the HER2 TKI approval in the first line setting. We know that the TKIs are active after the ADCs, but we have to learn about the converse. Can we use HER2 ADCs like T-DXd after HER2 TKIs? And then where does platinum fit in there as well? So we're thankful to have these different options for our patients now, but we do need to figure out the optimal sequencing. But of course, we want to use our best treatments first. So really in this space now, I think in my opinion, the HER2 TKIs really are the first line treatment of choice. And then to end, HER2 overexpression. So we talked about overexpression by IHC. So the initial study, DESTINY-Lung01, looked at 2+ as well as 3+, so moderate and high expressing criteria. And unsurprisingly, the higher the HER2 expression, the more confirmed responses that we get. In conclusion, trastuzumab deruxtecan was the first HER2-directed therapy for patients with HER2 mutations. It's now approved for both HER2-positive lung cancer after chemotherapy, as well as HER2-high-expressing lung cancers and all solid tumors after platinum-based chemotherapy. Zongertinib is a novel HER2 TKI that has activity, of course, in HER2-mutant non-small cell lung cancer and has the approval of line-agnostic treatment, including first-line for HER2-positive lung cancer. Severbertinib is similar novel HER2 TKI that has activity again in patients that have received chemotherapy, and it's being assessed in the first line setting as well. So a lot of new options in the space.
Next, Dr. Sands reviews the clinical data for TROP2 directed antibody drug conjugates in non-small cell lung cancer, including emerging results from ASCO 2026.
TROP2 antibody drug conjugates, when we look at these on paper, they all look the same. TROP2 antibody, hydrolyzable linker, topoisomerase inhibitor payload. The DARs are slightly different. I mean, in the spectrum, these are similar. There's some differences in the potency. So on paper, similar, but I think there are some real differences that we'll get into. So first of all, datopotamab deruxtecan, this is from the initial phase 1. And I just want to highlight, first of all, looking at three different dose levels, 4, 6, and 8 milligram per kilogram dose levels. These were the dose expansions. We see responses across all of them. And what I'm highlighting for you here is the data we have around the 4 mg per kg dose level. Of course, the recommended starting dose is 6 mg per kg. But, at 4, we see an efficacy signal that I think is still pretty compelling. And it just highlights that as we go through the data, and when Sarah talks about toxicities and such, that when a dose reduction is needed, I'm okay with that. I'm comfortable with it. Now, this is TROPION-Lung01. This was datopotamab deruxtecan versus docetaxel in all of non-small cell lung cancer. So squamous, non-squamous, tumors with and without actionable genomic alterations. Now, the cohort without actionable genomic alterations had to have chemo and immunotherapy. With actionable genomic alterations, had to have targeted therapy as well as platinum-based therapy, which I'll come back to. Now, of course, in the squamous population, we saw results that looked worse. In the non-squamous population is what we saw there, a median progression-free survival difference of 5.5 versus 3.6 months, response rates of 31 versus 13% when compared to docetaxel. In the intent to treat there on the far left is squam and non-squam, but really the benefit we saw in the non-squam group here, overall survival on the right is squamous, and you'll notice docetaxel looked better in the squamous cohort. In the non-squamous, there was a median OS difference from 14.6 to 12.3, hazard ratio of 0.84, confidence interval crossed 1, but what you notice on the bottom there is in when there was an actionable genomic alteration present, which 17% of patients enrolled had these genomic alterations, the OS was 15.6 as compared to 9.8 months. Smaller population, wider confidence interval, but really an impressive difference, I would say, in that smaller subset. Now, all right, so I'm going to get to TROPION-Lung05, which is a single arm study of Dato-DXd, same as the prior. The tumors with actionable genomic alterations had prior targeted therapy as well as prior chemotherapy. And so we're going to come back to this in a moment. But first of all, this is a first line study, PD-L1 high of sacituzumab govitecan plus Pembro versus Pembro alone. So the EVOKE-03 trial is an ongoing trial of these two. I showed you in the beginning sacituzumab govitecan looking very similar on paper. The toxicity profile of this drug is very different, and the dosing schedule is a little bit different. I know Sarah will get into some of the toxicities, but another high profile TROP2 ADC. So TROPION-Lung05, again, back with Dato-DXd, you see here 57% of patients enrolled to this trial had tumors with EGFR mutation. Now, sacituzumab govitecan had a similar trial versus docetaxel, and the primary endpoint of this was overall survival. And it did show a numerically better 11.1 months versus 9.8 with a hazard ratio of 0.84. The confidence interval did cross one and just missed statistical significance. So numerically more, but didn't quite meet the endpoint. There was a subgroup of those that had prior, without a response to the prior line of immunotherapy that could have been chemo-immuno. And within that group, we did see what looked like a bigger separation, 11.8 versus 8.3 months, hazard ratio 0.75. The EVOKE-02 trial is with sacituzumab govitecan. I'm trying to see it. The two cohorts there are in the greater than 50% PD-L1 and less than 50%, then going on sacituzumab govitecan plus pembrolizumab. Here is the waterfall plot of that. So, you know, very encouraging signal for decreasing volume of disease from a safety profile. I'll breeze through that. There wasn't really much more than we would expect when adding in pembrolizumab to that. Median PFS of 13 months in the greater than 50% and 7 months in the less than 50%. Now, SAC-TMT, this was just presented. This is the phase 3 OptiTROPE-Lung05 study with Pembro versus Pembro alone. This is first line therapy. Essentially, this is impressive data. From progression-free survival, we see the curves separate out here. I'll point out this is a study that has enrolled just in China at this point. There is a global trial that's currently enrolling. I highlight that because the outcomes we see in China, broadly speaking, seem to be a little bit better than what we see occur within global trials. And so I find this data very encouraging, and I think directionally this is often accurate and really exciting to see, and we'll have to see what happens with the global data. But here's progression-free survival by Bicker. I mean, the median of not yet reached versus 5.7 months, and this is at a year so far with 62% having ongoing disease control. Now, by PD-L1 expression, we have to look at these a little bit more. So keep in mind, this is anybody with at least 1% PD-L1 expression. So 1 to 49, we would typically treat with chemo Pembro, not Pembro alone. So the control arm here is not what we would typically use, but in the greater than 50%, Pembro alone is commonly utilized. And in this cohort, we see a hazard ratio of 0.47. So again, an impressive signal, median not reached versus 9.5 months. By histology, we're seeing efficacy in both squam and non-squam. Conclusion is that this is, I think, a drug that is certainly one to keep an eye out for, to watch the ongoing trials, and I look forward to that data. Now, this was previously published in New England Journal specifically to the EGFR population. And I'm going to skip a little bit through this and just show the PFS and OS curves within this. And so an encouraging signal within that population. From a toxicity standpoint, we did see alopecia with this. We see stomatitis with this. And although it wasn't on this chart because this was in the 10% or more events, there was ocular surface events in 9.6% of patients. So I think ocular surface and mucositis is TROP2 directed. Now, within TROPION-Lung01, there was an exploratory analysis looking for a biomarker. And this is essentially looking at TROP2 expression on the cell surface as compared to within the cytoplasm and a biomarker for that. And it was actually the increased expression within the cytoplasm relative to the membrane where that was positive. Now, if you look on here, the docetaxel arm, whether positive or negative, those curves overlap. And so this is not prognostic. And within the Dato-DXd arm, we see the curves separate out. So it is specific to Dato-DXd, this biomarker. And within TROPION-Lung01 shows an encouraging PFS signal. It was designed specifically for non-squamous, non-actionable genomic. And you can see on the table here that, you know, that biomarker is positive within other proportions. So in the non-squamous with actionable genomic alterations was positive in 76 versus in the squamous positive in only 44% of patients. So Dato-DXd is an FDA-approved TROP2 antibody drug conjugate in the EGFR mutation population after prior targeted therapy and platinum-based therapy. Sac-TMT has shown very encouraging results, not just in the EGFR mutation population, but also in the all-comers that we saw here. Now, is that Sac-TMT plus Pembro an indicator of what we may see from Avanzar and TROPION-Lung07 and 08 with Dato-DXd? And is that QCS-NMR biomarker potentially going to help further? That is yet to be demonstrated, so data to look forward to.
In the final segment, Dr. Goldberg discusses management of adverse events associated with HER2 and TROP2-directed therapies and gives practical guidance on dose optimization.
I am charged with discussing is the toxicities and not just what they are, but how to manage and mitigate them with HER2 and TROP2-directed therapy. So first, the easy part, which is the HER2 TKIs. I think I just have like one or two slides on this because we already talked about this. They're actually really pretty well tolerated. So this is the zongertinib data that you saw earlier briefly, showing that most toxicity with this drug is really mild, mostly grade 1 and grade 2. There is some grade 3 and higher toxicity, but really mild. There's some diarrhea, some rash, but overall well-tolerated. 11% of patients require dose reduction. So I think that really says a lot that even at full dose, this drug is fairly easy. Sevabertinib, as we mentioned earlier, overall, I would say a well-tolerated drug, but when you line it up against zongertinib, you see that some of the differences. Diarrhea was the most common treatment-related adverse event in this study. 86% of patients experienced diarrhea, although mostly it was grade 1 or grade 2, although there was 25% of patients who had grade 3 or higher. So this is really the main thing. It reminds me of, you know, the earlier generation of EGFR inhibitors, and probably because we are inhibiting EGFR as well with this drug. There was no ILD, which is important to note with either of these drugs. So I don't really know that I have to say that much about how to manage this. I think we all know how to manage EGFR toxicities from our vast experience with those. And overall, these are well-tolerated drugs. So moving into the ADCs. So in terms of T-DXd, looking at the HER2 ADC, we've had this drug now for several years. So I think, again, many of us are familiar with it. Overall, the toxicities that you see tend to be chemo-related. You see some nausea, some cytopenias. Alopecia is fairly common. I think the one thing that I really wanted to focus on is this, which again, we've already alluded to, is the ILD. So this is an example from a published report of a patient who had pneumonitis on T-DXd. You can see after even just one dose what happened to this patient with really significant bilateral ground glass opacities, and then the patient was started on prednisone and did significantly better in just a few weeks. So what is the risk of this? Well, it varies from study to study, but in this study that I'm showing here, the risk is between 13 and 28%, depending on the dose. And as we talked about, it's the lower dose that moved forward, in part because of the lower toxicity. Most of this was low grade, but there were some patients who had higher grade toxicity. And it's something to be aware of. Why does this happen? Why is this drug more commonly associated with ILD and pneumonitis than others? We don't really know. There are some proposed mechanisms you can see there. Potentially, there's off-target receptor-mediated uptake of the ADC in the lungs, but we don't really understand it. And so this is absolutely something to be aware of, not extremely common, but something important to watch your patients for. So how do we think about doing this? You probably can't read this, and neither can I, but I will just tell you, I think what's really important is what I'm highlighting here, something that maybe we don't think about often enough, which is what do we do even before we start our patients on a drug that could potentially cause pneumonitis? Well, in our patients with lung cancer, many of them have underlying lung disease anyway. We don't see it as much in patients who are never smokers, but in patients who are going to be getting T-DXd, potentially they have a smoking history, especially with the HER2 expressors. And so in patients who have baseline lung abnormalities, evidence of ILD or scarring, these are the patients we should really be thinking about having a consultation with a pulmonologist if they don't already have one. I've had patients that develop pneumonitis and I send them to a pulmonologist and they say, why didn't you send them to me before? They had baseline changes that would have been good to understand and evaluate before. So I think that's really important. Should we think about more evaluation even before starting treatment? Once the patient's on treatment, this is just one of those things you have to have a high suspicion for. Tell the patients to watch out for it, to call with any symptoms, and to get imaging when you have any concerns in terms of symptoms or low oxygen, of course. If you suspect ILD in these patients, this is really even when with grade 1 toxicity, which remember is just imaging only, we want to think about even potentially holding drug until we sort it out further and we see what direction the patient's going. In a few weeks, if you repeat a scan and it's better, maybe it wasn't ILD, maybe it's these waxing and waning infiltrates we sometimes will see and then continue on, or maybe we ruled in influenza or whatever else. But I think you really have to have a low threshold to even pause and further evaluate with these patients. And then when it's confirmed, when it's grade 2 or of course grade 3 and a higher grade, this was an algorithm in breast cancer, so I just have that disclaimer here. So how do we manage this? You know, there hasn't been a lot of really studies looking at how to manage ILD pneumonitis effectively. I looked at NCCN to see if it was in there, and actually it wasn't. The best I could find was how to manage immune checkpoint inhibitor-related toxicity. And actually, it's not all that different what we do. Whether that's appropriate or not, I don't know, but that's typically how we think about it. Again, asymptomatic is grade 1, imaging findings only. We should think about holding or at least following very closely. Grade 2 is when patients have any symptoms, and that's when we want to start thinking about treating with steroids and absolutely holding drug at least temporarily, if not permanently. And then for grade 3, following really closely, managing with steroids, higher doses of steroids if they're not getting better, and potentially even other immune suppression. In terms of the TROP2 ADCs, so you already saw a lot of this. I won't go into the details of what happens. I think really what's interesting is it's variable based on which TROP2 ADC you see. But some of the things tend to be more class effects than others. And obviously, we already heard about this was the stomatitis. You can see the frequency here in with Dato-DXd and TROPION-Lung01 study. Stomatitis was the most common drug-related adverse event. Nausea was also common. And because of adverse events, 20% of patients required a dose reduction. So this is what we were discussing before. When patients have toxicity, low threshold to pause and lower the dose so that it can be more tolerable and they can continue on. So in terms of looking at versus docetaxel, how are we comparing? I think we're all very familiar with docetaxel and the toxicities there. It does seem to have more mucositis than docetaxel. In terms of ILD, you see here this is an 8% risk in Dato-DXd, so lower than probably in T-DXd, but again, something we still see. Also not common, but again, some of these patients did have higher grades. You see a few patients there with grade 3 and 4, and then even a patient with death from ILD on this trial. How do we think about prophylaxis against stomatitis? I think it was Helena that mentioned giving dexamethasone mouthwash to all patients. It's something I do as well. When you start it, you give them the prescription so they can have it at home. There's also other recommendations that are out there. Gentle teeth brushing, really good dental hygiene with flossing when it doesn't hurt too much. again, using the steroid mouth rinse several times a day. Cryotherapy is something that we sometimes use, you know, ice pops or ice chips during the infusion. How much that helps, I don't know, but it's something easy that the patients can do. And then you can see here, step 2, monitor. So we always have to be asking our patients about this, seeing if it's impacting their quality of life. And then if it is, again, pause, think about lowering the dose, and then treating it more aggressively if not already. Again, the toxicities for even the TROP2 ADCs are different. So sacituzumab govitecan does not have a high incidence of stomatitis. It has a fairly high incidence, actually, of cytopenias. And you could see a high incidence of neutropenia here, even febrile neutropenia, and some deaths from this. So very different than what we see with other ADCs, and something to keep in mind here. I think what's going to be really interesting is as we see these combinations going forward. So we're already starting to see these drugs used in combination, and some of the toxicities can be overlapping, or, you know, something that it potentially could be potentiating. So I just wanted to show you 2 examples. One is a study that I already mentioned. This is one of the arms of the ORCHARD trial, where Dato-DXd was combined with osimertinib. We looked at 2 different doses here, the 4 mg per kg and 6 mg per kg. It's the 6 mg per kg that's going forward in phase 3 trials. But you can see I'm showing you just, there's other toxicities obviously that you can look at, but I just wanted to highlight the stomatitis and the ILD pneumonitis risk. And it does look like they're both potentially higher when you combine with osimertinib. Not so surprisingly, overall the risks are still are there regardless, but I think when you're looking at combinations, it's something, again, to be aware of, especially as I mentioned, sometimes using this off-label, that tox is more significant. Combining with immune therapy and with platinum chemotherapy, this is very high-level overview with just some nice pictures to just keep us all awake. We are seeing all the same toxicities when you use Dato, whether it's in combination or not, but again, potentially increased. So you see the risk of ILD or pneumonitis increases here. So the any grade pneumonitis goes up to even 25% when the triplet was used. So again, something to watch out for, especially when combinations are used. So to summarize here, the HER2 TKIs are generally well tolerated, especially zongertinib. ADCs, they really do have unique toxicities, even within the same class. ILD pneumonitis is something to watch out for. Stomatitis, of course, cytopenias as well. We do have some interventions that can help to prevent some of these toxicities, and absolutely should be utilized to help keep patients on drug. But if patients do develop toxicities, identifying it early, pausing drug, lowering the dose, and aggressively managing them is really important. And as we get more combinations, there could be more overlapping toxicities. So very much important to keep all of these tips in mind with the combinations as well.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.